Dr. Edward Fitzgerald is the Health Equity and Access Co-Lead at KPMG International and Head of Healthcare and Life Sciences at KPMG Islands Group. He joins me in the studio to discuss health policy. So what's different about delivering healthcare on an island?
It's a fascinating area and also one that does get a little bit neglected. If you look at international health policy or studies or research in this area, islands do get a little bit overlooked when it comes to healthcare. I think healthcare is hard wherever you are in the world at the moment, but I like to say that it's as if islands apply a magnifying glass to some of those challenges, be that scale, geographical location, range of services, workforce, many, many different issues face island healthcare. So it is an interesting area and one that probably actually ought to get a lot more attention from policy and research.
In terms of island healthcare then, what specifically is going to be different about us as compared with a hospital in England somewhere?
So it's a good question. And I think to put that in context, there's a few inputs that you need to consider around that. One is the geographical location. Another is the local health of the community and what they need. Another is the critical mass in terms of specialisms, services and sophistication of those, what's available. The funding model and the financing and the way that it's set up, and all of those will vary a little bit between islands. But as a whole, those will be some of the issues that you need to think about in terms of how you determine what's being offered. And so, starting with the first point, the geographic location is important. You know, if you're on a mainland, any mainland anywhere, your ability to phone a friend, to refer a patient, to ask for help, to escalate, is very, very different. Being able to put someone in an ambulance and send them down the road compared to needing a helicopter, an aeroplane or a boat for an emergency medical evacuation when a higher level of care is needed, that alone has huge logistical, financial and care implications on thinking about what's delivered and where is the best place that it's delivered. If you think about the health needs of the population, well, you actually need to look at a breadth of issues, the demographics. Different people at different ages will have different health needs. And the demographics of many of the islands we're working in are materially different from mainland settings, whether that's an emphasis on our younger population or an older population. Also the longevity of that population, all of that will determine the resource allocation that you need to make in thinking about what healthcare services are offered for those different time points in life. And so just two examples, but a lot of different factors will determine things that will make it materially different running and delivering healthcare on an island compared to a mainland setting.
And of course, we had all collectively been getting older, we had a longer life expectancy, and that seemed to be increasing year on year for a while. Longevity, the increase seems to have stalled a little bit in recent years.
I think COVID's had a big role in that, and that's a picture that we've seen internationally. I think the general trend will recover and remain. Every year there are new treatments being developed, there are new medicines being developed, there are improvements to care and services. So while undoubtedly any graph that you look at tends to show a blip around the COVID period and thereafter, I would anticipate that we'll see a return to that uptrend of increasing longevity and long years of life again going forwards.
And of course, there's two aspects to living a longer life. One is exactly what it says, you live to an older age. But probably the more important thing for people, if they are going to live into their 80s, 90s, or even reaching a century, that they would hope to have a reasonable quality of life. And extending life doesn't always mean extending a reasonable quality of life.
Well, that's absolutely right. And I think you can look at it from the health and wellness perspective. You can also take a hard line and look at it from the financial costs of care perspective. There's very good evidence that shows the most expensive point of anyone's life, where the greatest health expenditure will occur, is often the last 12 months of life. But if you look at that, are people enjoying health and wellness as you suggest? Are they able to have enjoyable years of life in their old age, or are they immobile, in a difficult situation, and not really able to get the most out of that? I think there is a risk, and this is a philosophical point, but there is a risk with modern medicine that purely extending life because we can, because there's a medicine there, for people who aren't able to enjoy that. And in fact, you know, people who may have an increasing need to draw on the health system, does that benefit them? Does that benefit themselves? Does that benefit society? That's a moot point to discuss. But I think everyone can agree there is a need to ensure greater prevention and wellness, so that healthy life years are maintained as long as possible, and that people themselves feel that they're really getting value out of living longer. You know, that really should be a joy for people, not a burden.
And of course, one of the problems that comes with living a longer life is that it costs more. Have we cracked this? Because of course, not only do you have longer lives, people living longer, but you also have more and more medical treatments available. So both of those basically mean that anybody's health budget, any government anywhere around the world, is that their health budget is effectively increasing exponentially.
Well, it's a very pertinent question. And I think, have we cracked it? I think we've got a pretty good idea. I mean, I was a surgeon originally, so forgive the mechanical metaphor, but I think of myself as a bit of a used car. And as I get older, I'm going to need more maintenance, my part's going to break, there's going to be a point when I'm not safe to be driven on the road anymore. But just like looking after a car, getting that preventative maintenance in, fixing problems early, taking the right steps at an early stage will give you a car a longer life. Now, parts are always going to break. They're always going to break. But if you can push that out into later in a car's life and keep it running, well, humans are the same. And so have we cracked it? Well, the key point is, and unfortunately translated to humans, people don't always want to hear this, and that's why I use the car metaphor. You know, people don't always want to take the right behavioural steps to look after their health early in life. Exercise, limiting harmful behaviours, be that drinking or smoking, making sure that you've got a healthy diet, all of those things that will push out that maintenance and those parts breaking for as long as you can. But that needs people to invest in themselves and to make those changes. And you know, I'm sure as guilty as the next person that I can't always do that. But the problem is, if we don't, those parts will break earlier, and then that's when it really starts to cost the health system.
And of course, expanding your metaphor, and apologies for doing this, the car tends to be getting fueled more often by high octane rocket fuel, which then results in another of the problems that we have, which is a lot of people are overweight or obese because they're eating very, very high levels of calorie intense foods, and then that adds to the health problem.
You're right, and I think thinking about a car, there's always things you can do to spruce it up. There's always little extras that you can bolt on. Do they really make you go faster? Do they really extend the life of your car? So there's always going to be new fads and new treatments that may or may not actually fundamentally benefit things. But you're absolutely right. Thinking about, you know, how you run it and how you take care of it, what fuel you put in the tank is going to make a real difference to how it runs down the line as well. And that is a societal issue, and that's, you know, that isn't just an island issue, although it's interesting that it does seem to be particularly marked and prominent in many of the islands that I am working in. I think there's some cultural issues in there. It varies very much by island as well, and I don't know the situation in Isle of Man, But it's not uncommon working in some of the islands where we're working. We do see, compared to mainland comparators, higher levels of obesity, higher levels of diabetes. That's not uncommon. And I don't know the situation here, but it's getting to that fundamental point that you've got to invest in the right prevention and wellness early to help people stay well for longer and to reduce the knock-on costs on the health system. Some of the ways that that's done, depending on the island we're working in, there are incentives for that. There is legislation around that. Some islands have introduced sugar taxes. Other islands are incentivizing other wellness behaviors to try and give that nudge to help people stay healthy and perhaps be a little bit more modest about the fuel that they're putting into the car.
And then the other glaringly obvious question that perhaps I should have asked at the beginning of the interview is, KPMG, they do maths and sums and things, and they make sure that people's books are in order and possibly give a bit of business advice from time to time. Why on earth do they need a medical expert, let alone an expert on island healthcare?
It's a great question, and I'm smiling as I answer that, because I do hear that a lot, and I hear that sometimes from my own KPMG colleagues as well. You're absolutely right, and I should have said at the outset that I'm not an accountant, and I sometimes smile because I feel like I am apologising for that. But you're absolutely 100% right. KPMG is recognised around the world as a professional services firm. What's less well appreciated is we do actually have very significant healthcare advisory work internationally. A very big team working globally, working in over 70 countries. We've got over 200 clinicians supporting that work, really helping support a much wider group working across the broad spectrum of healthcare. And while my days of holding a sharp scalpel are behind me, we're much more focused now on healthcare management. And yes, as you say, we are much better known for the math and the numbers. And yes, healthcare costs a lot, and a significant part of our work is bringing some of that financial know-how and knowledge to thinking about how we can optimize care. But our work is much broader than that, whether that's helping support the first steps of universal health coverage in islands in the Caribbean, to foundational health system strengthening, thinking about the right governance, the right regulation, the right procurement, to thinking about some more of the operational sides of health system financing, thinking about productivity, efficiency, cost saving, given the ever rising year on year costs of healthcare. We help think about data and analytics. We help think about workforce and workforce optimization. And all of those areas, it's one of the reasons I love healthcare so much, is because the whole world is there, and healthcare is really a people-centered business. And so I'm able to draw on my clinical background, but I also take great pleasure in being able to bring in some of our specialists internationally to share their experience in some of those areas, but also colleagues working in some of those other areas as well, who can contribute to the healthcare question. But healthcare is something that is seen as being a little bit specialist. And so sometimes I have to hold the hand of some of my colleagues who work and have that greater specialism in other areas outside of healthcare to bring them in and help them contribute to the conversation with their specialist knowledge. And that's part of the joy of doing the work that we do.
Certainly our Chief Minister has described the spiralling cost of delivering health services on the Isle of Man as seriously endangering the economic prospects of the island, because we can't afford to do all the other things that government needs to do if we continue to increase our spending on healthcare to the extent that has been happening in the last few years. Is the Isle of Man alone in facing this problem, or is this an issue that you see in many of the islands you visit?
Well, the Isle of Man is absolutely not alone. I mean, this is a monumental challenge for many islands. And we are having very similar, seeing similar things, having similar conversations elsewhere, Last year, we were just working elsewhere in the Crown Dependencies, supporting Jersey with a financial recovery plan for the hospital. And we're doing exactly the same in the other side of the Atlantic as well. As I said earlier, island settings do bring a magnifying glass to the problems that we're seeing in healthcare universally. And if you even back on the mainland, healthcare inflation, you know, people now are talking about inflation having come down. Healthcare inflation is still out of proportion, running at a higher level. Every year, there are new treatments, new medications, new interventions to be made, to be introduced. The cost of healthcare workforce staff, because of the global healthcare workforce crisis that we're seeing, that is absolutely impacting on our islands as well. The challenges in being able to bring in the right specialisms and indeed healthcare staff being poached from the island, and difficulty in retention. So absolutely, it's a really significant problem. And I think the Isle of Man would not be alone in wondering whether islands are facing an existential threat in this area if things aren't able to be gotten under control.
A mere 20 years ago, I was a member in the health department, a political member for health. And at that stage, we had general orthopaedic surgeons who could effectively pretty much operate on any joint that you had a problem with. You can't do that now, can you? Because of the standards and possibly because of the litigious nature of the society in which we live, medics have to be experts in increasingly discrete areas to be able to get the training they need and the necessary insurances they need to be able to practice. How do islands overcome that? Because in certain instances, there will be, I don't know, joints that very rarely need to have a surgeon working on them, and effectively, if you have a specialist surgeon in that area, they then don't have the necessary hours of practice to be able to keep their training up to date.
I think you're absolutely right to flag that. It is that is one of those challenges that is particular to island settings and also to remote and rural care internationally. Healthcare, without any doubt, has become much more specialist in the last 20, 30 years, even during my career. And the era of, certainly when I was doing my training, the senior consultants had so much experience. They had seen it all and done it all. And even if they might not have done it recently, at least they had done it or had seen it. These days, generalists, if I can say it, it's not coming out of medical school or allied healthcare professionals, it isn't always seen as being sexy to be a generalist these days. And unfortunately, the nature of medical training, medical care, the ever-increasing degree of knowledge that's required is taking medicine in that direction of greater and greater specialism. On the mainland, where I did some of my training in Nottingham, we had a department of 20-something orthopaedic consultant surgeons. So it was fine if your specialism was the elbow or the shoulder. You could run an entire practice just based on that one joint. These days, it's difficult to find someone who has the breadth of experience through their training to be more generalist. And that's not just an orthopaedic challenge. That's really across the board in medicine. And the knock-on effect for that in islands, where you don't have the critical mass to support a department of 20 surgeons in just one specialty, is really being felt. And I think while it's a challenge to get people in who are comfortable dealing with the breadth of care that they might need to deliver in an island setting, the knock-on effect of that is if you can't, then it gets very expensive starting to refer people to centres of excellence where they can.
Are there any examples that you've seen on your travels of really good practice, places where island governments have really cracked this whole health funding and health care delivery problem?
So I have to say it's one of the joys of this role is being able to spend time in different islands and get under the bonnet of what they're doing. And one of the points I often make is it really surprises me in my travels how little islands are talking to one another about healthcare, because I think everybody tends to look, whichever side of the Atlantic you're on, you tend to look at the mainland as a comparator. But actually, there's so much more learning that could be shared from hospitals and health systems across the islands themselves, because they're dealing with different challenges and they found different solutions. And often those solutions are going to be different in an island setting. What works for one isn't necessarily what's going to work for another. And I should say, I haven't seen any one island that's got it all cracked, but I absolutely have seen different islands that have made significant advances in some particular areas that could really be sharing that for the benefit of others as well. And so I think looking at the advent of telehealth, I think, is one particular issue. We've seen good examples of where that's being used. Telehealth has seen some real advances, particularly around specialist approaches in mental health care, and we've seen that being used in the Bahamas. I think mental health care is an area that's particularly open to being able to be more amenable to telehealth, but absolutely by no means simply that. We've definitely seen, for example, in Bermuda, perhaps less on the patient-facing side, but we've seen instances of telehealth now being fairly regularly used for discussing specialist cancer cases as part of a multidisciplinary team meeting, being able to link in to specialist histopathologists, radiologists, oncologists to help guide local clinicians in making the right decisions and treatment plans, and being able to share information, radiological, histopathological, or otherwise, to guide a plan of care. And not always does that require a patient to go overseas. That conversation can happen between clinical professionals. So lots of good examples, I think.
And of course, as a doctor, you don't have to worry about the politics of these things. But as politicians, the part of the problem that we have is everyone is bought into the idea, particularly in this part of the world anyway, that health services should be free at the point of delivery. Putting your KPMG hat on, is it possible for us to continue with that that vision for health, or do we actually have to start rethinking the whole way in which we deliver health services?
Well, I would say, even as a doctor and even before KPMG days, it would be nice if we didn't have to worry about politics and healthcare. But healthcare is intrinsically political. And I also think that is a magnifying glass on islands as well, by the way, because healthcare for islands is really a safety net for the community. It's an anchor for an entire island. Good care can be really attractive in helping bring in overseas business and can support tourism, for example. Poor care ends up really undermining an island, and that's where's the attraction for people to come. And in fact, people can leave, businesses and islanders. So I get that healthcare is absolutely intrinsically political. And, you know, in its own way, healthcare is in the mainland as well. I think you raise a good point, though. I mean, this relates to the earlier point of the ever-rising costs of care. And I think islands have to be realistic. And that's not really, that's not to say that it can't be sustainable. But I think there's a bigger question about what an island community expects and what can be delivered within the resources of what's available. And that isn't to minimise things, because where things aren't available, well, what are the corridors for getting that, and how can that be done in the most efficient and cost-effective way? For healthcare that is going to be delivered in the island, is it being run as efficiently and as effectively and as productively as it can be? Are all of the opportunities being taken to ensure that good care is being delivered through the most cost-effective ways possible? And I should say, in many islands where we're working, that isn't always the case. And I think if you look at somewhere like the National Health Service, it's been squeezed hard for a very long time. And some people will have opinions about that. But internationally, in my work, I think everybody respects the fact that National Health Service care stretches the pound that's spent on healthcare about as much as it's possible to be stretched. Is that the case in many of the islands where we're working? I would say probably not, actually. And if you know, think of some of the work we've been doing, when you scratch the surface, there are opportunities to improve and get the most value for care, better value for care than is currently being delivered. And I think there are some obvious stones that need turning over to look at. In many health systems where we're working, if you look at what some of the biggest costs of care are, it comes down to the medicines and indeed the healthcare interventions that are being made. Are they the right medicines? Are they the most cost effective? Are they delivering the best value? And where that care can't be provided on an island, well, where is the best deal being negotiated to obtain that elsewhere, if it is right, proper, appropriate care? What partnerships are being made? What collaborations are being put in place to support that? And thinking to the future, that's really here right now, what are the right digital-based opportunities to be able to really think about what the future of care looks like? Thinking about earlier detection, earlier prevention of care to save some of those costs that can be occurred later on. So I think there's actually a lot of opportunities within islands to make healthcare sustainable. But to your point, if islands, not just the Isle of Man, but thinking more generally, if islands carry on the trajectory they're on without doing a deep dive on some of those opportunities, then I think, yes, we will start to question whether that's sustainable for an island going forward.
That was Head of Healthcare and Life Sciences at KPMG Islands Group, Dr. Edward Fitzgerald. So, what do you think? Can we learn from other islands' experiences? Can we afford not to? For now, I'm Phil Gorn. Goramayo. Thanks for listening.